Hello friends, I'm your host Chris Thrall. I'm a former Royal Marines Commando. I've adventured, for better and sometimes worse, across 80 countries on all 7 continents. Welcome to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast. Simon, how are you, sir?
I'm good, thanks.
You're in Joburg, did you say?
I am in Joburg, yeah.
Wow.
Lovely weather, no lockdown, it's fine.
Oh, wow. Yes, I was there when I went to work in Mozambique. We stopped, obviously our flight came into South Africa. And we stayed at a lodge there in Joburg called Brown Sugar. Have you ever heard of it?
No.
Oh, it was, let's just say one night in Johannesburg is as good as one night in Bangkok.
Okay, really?
Maybe not so many girls, but well, not where we were. But yes, it was quite a memorable occasion.
Well, as you can see from the background, I'm in a very nice house in Santon, so.
Yes, I had a great time there, and I'm of that age. I grew up seeing the the uprising on television. So the Zulus reacting against the security forces.
Yeah.
Our young people listening might be surprised, but our news every night was filled with people running down the road with spears, chasing after the police or and the police firing off their baton rounds. Yes, incredible. So when I got to Johannesburg, Simon, it was quite, I don't think emotional is the right word, but it was certainly a special moment to see a place that had been so much in my history, in my youth, and to see the big mine dumpings, just incredible.
Yeah, well, I'm actually half South African. So my mother was South African and I have a South African passport. So I'm very familiar with what you're talking about. And yeah, quite amazing.
I mean, you went to Eton, that's right.
I did, yep.
Yeah, I gave a talk to Eton the other day, funnily enough. I never thought in my life I'd be talking to Eton students, but they seem to appreciate the realism in what I said. I know a bit about Africa's colonial history. You had some vicious fighting, Mozambique, obviously, Angola. Yeah, I just wondered, how is it, you know, if you're half South African, does that throw up issues, or do you notice a sort of lack of
knowledge? The first time I came to South Africa, I was 6, and it was 1958, and we came by sea. Wow. And my grandparents obviously were living here, and so it's always been a part of my life that. And I mean, I tend to find that, we're all sons of the empire to a certain degree, one, you know, more or less. Very few English people have no connection with any part of the old empire. Mm. You know, cousins in Canada, cousins in Australia, this, that, something or other. And I think probably not so much now, but certainly my generation was very much the norm, I think. You know, the people who were born in India, their fathers had served in the Indian army or God knows what, but there were loads and loads of that sort of, those sort of connections. And it's actually a bit of a hobby horse of mine, because what I find in Africa is an enormous residual goodwill towards the UK. And funnily enough, that is as strong, sometimes stronger, in the non-British colonies, because they had the misfortune of being colonized by somebody else.
Yes, there's such rich history in Africa. I read a lot of Wilbur Smith's books. I don't know what his reputation is over there, but certainly gives you a flavour of the depth of history that there is there.
Oh yeah, I'm a big Wilbur Smith fan.
Yeah.
I actually thought that they were sort of training manuals for a while.
Yes. Yes. Were you living in England when you joined the army?
Yeah. No, so we never, well, actually, no, that's not true. I mean, but as in terms of how I was brought up, I didn't live in South Africa. I think the longest I was here continuously was 18 months. Mm. I, in fact, went to live in South Africa in 1997, and we lived there for 6 years, which was great. We lived in Cape Town. Mm. I didn't live here as a boy.
Yeah. And you were Scots Guards, is that right?
I was, yes, yeah, Scots Guards, yeah, absolutely. Which is a bit strange because not even slightly Scottish. But yeah. My grandfather joined Scots Guards in the First World War, and that's why it became family regiment.
I see. Is that usual if you come out of Sandhurst that you can go to any, I mean, you could go to the Gurkhas, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly in my day, so now we're talking quite a long time ago, so sort of 1969, I mean, when you went to Sandhurst, which I did, because in those days there was Sandhurst and Mons. And Sandhurst was regular officers, Mons was short service. I wanted to go to Sandhurst, become a regular officer, and you kind of pretty much sort of booked your place with your regiment probably before you went to Sandhurst. You know, you knew where you wanted to go, and you would have had an interview with them before you went to Sandhurst. And so they would sometimes reject people, and they'd say, well, you know, good luck at Sandhurst, but we don't think you're what we want. That obviously didn't happen to me, but that could happen. And so it was a whole sort of jockeying, you know, and also even then there were only a limit, there were a fixed number of places that the regiments could fill. So if they had too many people wanting to come in, then, you know, they couldn't take them all. Although that definitely wasn't the case with the Scots Guards in my day. We were very badly recruited for officers.
And the SAS for an officer, I'm assuming the selection is the same as the men, is that right?
Yeah, you do the same. You have to get a better grade than they do on test week. And then you do officers week, which is an extra sort of bolt on. Especially for you, which is officers week was hard.
Wow. What's hard about it? I'm guessing physical.
Well, no, it's because in my case, we just finished test week. We come straight off test week onto officers week. So you're tired anyway. So they've achieved that. You're absolutely knackered. The difficult part about it that I found is that on test week, it's purely objective. I mean, you've just got to make the times, you know, you've just got to make those times and get the grade. And that's on the watch and on the paper. Officers week is much more about whether they like you or not as an officer. And so it's quite hard not to start trying to second guess it, if you know what I mean? So they ask you a question or they throw something at you, and you're, instead of just reacting, you're thinking, oh, what do they want me to say? You know, what am I meant to say? Which of course is potentially fatal.
Yes. Was it always on the cards you were going to go on selection? Was that your goal from the beginning?
Yeah, it was actually. My cousin, Lockie McLean, was in the SAS. In the 60s. And I mean, he went to Borneo, served in Borneo, his Guards Independent Parachute Company, then SAS. In fact, he was one of the founding troop commanders of G Squadron for SAS historians. And so I was at school and hearing about my cousin's exploits, and I thought, right, this is what I want to do.
Wow. And I've seen pictures of you in the Northern Ireland conflict, haven't I?
Might have done.
Yeah.
I did a lot of tours.
Oh, did you really?
I did 6 tours.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Were you paratrained?
Yes, Simon? because in the Special Air Service. Ah. But in fact, I did the at Sandhurst, I did the what was called the Edward Bear course, which was the you basically did the parachute course as an officer cadet. Mm-hmm. So I did that for fun, basically. I mean, you volunteered for it. And then, of course, you do parachute training in the SAS. Everybody does.
Yeah. You do a lot of it, don't you?
Quite a bit, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends, because if you're a free faller, you know, if you're in free fall troop, each squadron has a free fall troop. And so obviously, if you're a free faller, then you do a hell of a lot of it. Mm-hmm. The rest of us sort of muddle along. And the funny thing was that the one thing that the free fallers absolutely hated was static line, which is what we all were doing. You know, they were fine jumping out at 20,000 feet at night with oxygen and a Bergen on their legs. And oh my God, I don't know how they did it. Mm. But you say to them, okay, we're going to jump at 600 feet on a static line. They say, oh my God, no, we don't want to do that.
Yes. I did 2 parachute courses. The first one, we got as far as the balloon jump, and then it was cancelled because all the Hercules went out to the first Gulf War.
Right.
But I shared my room with 2 SAS guys. And they were probably like the 2 most humble people I've ever met. I think that might surprise a lot of people, but you just would not know that these guys were the, you know, the elite of the elite.
No, some of the guys are very surprising.
There was one time where they were bimbling along. I think we were going to what you guys would call scoff, what we call scran. And the RSN came out. He went, "You two, put your effing berries on now." And these 2 troopers just went, carried on walking. It was
is he talking to us?
Yeah, well, they were like, you know, nobody talks to us that way, sorry.
Yeah, well, that's I remember when I did my parachute course, the second time I did it with the which was with the SAS, and I, you know, obviously I don't think I need to say that, but as a young officer you're pretty nervous. And the parachute course is at the end of your SAS selection and continuation. And it's almost like a sort of holiday, really, because, you know, you've been through the whole thing and now you've got 2 weeks away from camp and you're just going to, you know, do these jumps, which we'd all done before anyway. And we were with, I don't know, 40 or 50 parachute regiment recruits. And they really were parachute regiment recruits. You know, they'd just done P Company and now they're going to do their jump. And so I think there were about 8 or 9 of us SAS guys on this course with these 40 or 50 parachute regiment guys. And I think we'd done the first jump from the aircraft, and the SAS guys formed up to me as the Rupert and said, "Right, boss, listen, we want you to go and talk to the commandant of this place, because we're not going to jump with those beep, diddy, beep, beep, beeps again." And I said, well, what do you mean? And they said, well, they're just dangerous because they're so gung-ho. All they want to do is charge out the back of that aeroplane. There's no thought of timing between the doors, you know, left, right, left, right. And we don't want to jump with them. So I thought, oh, God, now what? You know, so anyway, have to go and form up to the RAF commanding officer, I think, tell him the situation. He looked at me and he said, "You know what, Simon, I don't blame them and I don't blame you. It's fine, you'll all jump as your own stick." It was quite funny.
Yes. As a Marine, I always had to make sure I was the first one out because we had a load of baby paras in with us as well.
And, so you know exactly what I'm talking about. Oh,
there was one time in the balloon, they say, right, number off. So I'm like, one, you know, just my arm was straight up. So basically for our friends listening, that means you're first in the door. And he said, right, number one to the door. And I stepped forward, arms across the reserve. And I just turned around and said, I'll see you guys on the ground. Geronimo! Like that. And then when I caught up with them in the hangar, I said, yeah, did you think it was funny when I said, I'll see you guys on the ground? And he said, actually, Chris, we were just shitting ourselves. Didn't really hear what you said.
Didn't hear you.
Yeah, gosh. Great experience throwing yourself out of aeroplanes.
Yeah. No, I preferred aeroplanes to the balloon, actually. I must admit. So there was something very clinical about the balloon jump.
Yeah, it's like it's a base jump technically, isn't it? Which is kind of, it all seems so much more serious if it's going to open or not. Because if it doesn't, you haven't really got much height to rectify it.
No, and in the aeroplane, you've got all that noise and the smell and the shouting and the sort of the whole stick going out and all of that. Whereas the balloon, it's very quiet. There you go. Off you go, sir, kind of thing. And very different. And then, of course, you're going to fall straight down. You're not going to go sideways with the movement of the aircraft.
They took the balloon up to 4-5 commando, and the guys were just giving their mates their woolly pullies with their para wings on and going, go on, you go for it. And there's guys going out doing backflips and somersaults, and the PGIs are saying, are you sure that guy's para trained?
No. Well, that was quite funny on the... what they used to call stud splash, you know, jumping into Studland Bay.
Okay.
And we used to do that because I was a boat troop. And so we did quite a lot of water stuff with pool, actually. We were down there quite a lot. And in those days, they used to allow non-paratrained civilians to jump off the tailgate of the C-130. Into the sea, because why not, you know, what can possibly go wrong? But it turned out that actually quite a lot could possibly go wrong, because one guy dropped his reserve, you know, said it. So when he released one side of the reserve, he didn't release one side of the reserve, he released both sides of the reserve, but I mean it's about 500 feet up, so this reserve comes down, and the booties in the Geminis were sort of laughing. So they had to make sure they didn't land on them. And then the next guy that came out misjudged the distance completely. And I don't know what height he was when he fell out of his harness, but quite high, high enough for everyone to go, ooh.
Yeah, the things you do when you're young.
Yeah. Well, it was pretty good fun. Mm. I loved it.
How has it been a help? Or a hindrance, Simon, being you, I mean, you're tagged with mercenary everywhere you go, or well, obviously throughout social media. Is how have you found that?
Well, that's a pain, because, you know, mercenary is a fairly pejorative word for most people, and it's a sort of pointless debate, because, you know, you can talk about what is a mercenary all day long. And some people would say, well, any professional soldier surely is a mercenary. And then you have, well, no, because that's for Queen and country. Really? Well, a Gurkha isn't, you know, he doesn't come from here, so is he a mercenary? And that whole debate is completely pointless, really. And so I sort of avoid it. And in fact, on LinkedIn, for those who follow LinkedIn, I've been arguing that we ought to be called condottieri, which is the Italian for mercenary, and it just sounds so much better.
it's kind of funny to place you even in that scene, because I mean, I've had guys I was in the Marines with, they've gone out and they've done, you know, security on diamond mines in Africa or Angola, and it's not unusual for guys to come out of an elite force or a special force and go and do that line of work, isn't it? Not really caring what the parameters of the or the politics are, but if there's a big paycheck at the end of it. But you am I right in thinking you were more trying to do the right thing, or was there an element of I'm going to get paid a lot for this as well?
No, I mean it's you know, it's I've written a book. You know, I've got a book called Cry Havoc. Actually, funny enough, it's behind me. This is my friend's house, but this is actually, the book's actually somewhere up in there.
I'm going to put a link for it under our video, Simon.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Well, it's and so, I mean, basically, I rejoined. Without telling and having to tell the whole story again, but I mean, I rejoined the British Army because of the first Gulf War, and I was on the staff of Peter de la Billière, and that all came to an end in February 92. And I was offered a job back in the Special Air Service, actually, arranged by Peter, because I was on a TA attachment to do my service with him. And they would convert it back to being a regular commission, blah, blah, blah. And then Tony Buckingham at the same time started Heritage Oil and Gas, which I'd actually helped him a little bit with, and said, no, come on, you know, you've done the whole army thing. It's time you made some proper money. Come and join me in Heritage. I said, okay, I really actually probably ought to try and do that and make some proper money. And lo and behold, what was it, about 7 months later, I was a general in the Angolan army at war. So my attempt at becoming a civilian was an abject failure. And the reason we were in that position was because basically UNITA, who were the guerrillas, having signed an agreement and having made all sorts of promises, went against their agreement and against their promises, and they went back to war, having lost the elections of November 92. It was a really big deal, because I mean, that was what got the Russians and the Cubans and the South Africans and the Americans all out of Angola, all in the lead up to that election. Long story. Anyway, they went back to war, and the first thing they did was they attacked our operating base, which is a place called Soyo, on the mouth of the River Congo. And we decided that we would fight back, that we wouldn't just say, okay, we're going home and pack our bags. We thought, no, you know, these guys are committing a huge crime against humanity going back to war. They signed an agreement, they made a peace treaty, they've got no right to go back to war whatsoever. And they've attacked us, you know, our men, our kit, our livelihood, to hell with them. So we pitched the idea to the Angolans. They liked it, and that was effectively the beginning of Executive Outcomes. I mean, Executive Outcomes existed before that, but hadn't done anything of that sort at all. And the next thing, we're in a pitched battle to recapture Soyo, which is all quite well known, quite well documented. And so, you know, it wasn't like a deliberate decision to go and fight or become a security guy. It was actually the opposite. I was hoping I was going to become an oil and gas man, but it wasn't to be. And so the whole mercenary thing there is quite annoying in a way, because, you know, how are we mercenaries? You know, we're acting almost in self-defense. We're acting on behalf of our company and our livelihood. And secondly, we're like Gurkhas, because we were all signed up into the Angolan armed forces. You know, I had an ID card, badges of rank, all the rest of it. So that doesn't normally fulfill the mercenary, you know, definition.
Yeah. My gosh. So yeah, so I see. And how did you go from there to the Equatorial Guinea situation?
Oh, well, that was much later. So the Angolan stuff all happened in 93. So that's when Executive Outcomes really started as a mercenary company. And I think it's important to actually differentiate between, you know, private security company, private military company, and what Executive Outcomes was, because, you know, a lot of these, what they call PMCs, what are they actually doing? You know, they're guarding an embassy or they're escorting VIPs around. And yeah, if they get shot at, they'll shoot back, fine. But they don't go to a government and say, we'll help you win your war. We'll come and fight this war with you and we'll help you win it, which is what Executive Outcomes did. And that is a rather different thing. But anyway, while Angola was going on, we started Sierra Leone, and shortly after that, while that was going on, Papua New Guinea happened, that big mess, and then the arms to Sierra Leone scandal, which resulted in the resignation of Robin Cook. All of those dramas happened. And that was basically when I thought, oh, I think I'll take the family down to Cape Town and relax in the vineyards of Constantia. Which is what I did until 2003. And that was when I was recruited to do the Equatorial Guinea failed coup attempt.
Oh, am I right in thinking you were tricked into, or just, was it double-crossed?
No, it's a long story, but you know, no, I was recruited to do it. I said, yeah, I agreed to do it. I wanted to do it. And, it went wrong, you know, and my mistake, my fault. I should have called it off, but I didn't. And we were arrested.
How did Mark Thatcher get involved? What was he looking to get out of this?
Well, how he got involved was that basically the guy who should have been backing the whole thing and driving the show, who is the guy who recruited me, it's a guy called Eli Khalil, who's now dead. And he wasn't backing us properly, and basically the whole thing was going to fail. It was just going to fall apart, not going to happen. And I needed $200,000 to keep the show on the road. And I thought, well, who is crazy enough to just, you know, write out a check for $200,000 to be a part of this and to make this happen? And Mark was, you know, a friend, really. I mean, sort of more of an acquaintance than a friend, but he was a friend in a way down in Cape Town. And, you know, we used to have dinner parties together and all that business. But I didn't really know him that well, but I thought, yeah, well, I think Mark would love to do this. So he joined in, signed up, paid his 200,000. And then when the shit hit the fan, wham, he got absolutely clobbered.
Yes, I bet. When you were arrested in, was it Harare Airport? So you're on your way to Equatorial Guinea.
Yeah, that's right.
And you were going to pick up your weapons in Zimbabwe.
Harare, yeah.
Yeah. So how did that play out? And at what point did you think, oh shit, it's...
Yeah, well, actually, I'd been there for a few days because what we were doing was collecting the arms and ammunition, as you say, and the aeroplane came in, my lovely Boeing 727, which we'd just bought, and with the men on board. And the idea was, they were just going to stop, load the stuff on, and away we go. And I went to check over the weapons and got onto the back of a truck, and there were very few weapons there, and I thought, something's really wrong here. And then I heard this voice saying, get down from the truck. And that's it, we were under arrest.
Oh my God. Did they arrest all of your men?
Oh yeah, yeah, everyone went to prison. The men for 18 months, a year or 18 months, depending, in Harare, Chikurubi Max. Chick Max, they call it the Harare Hilton.
Yeah, these places get the tag Hilton, don't they?
It's not a good place.
I'm guessing, ironically. And where did you recruit those guys from? Were they a, you know, were they a ragtag bunch of bandits, or were they all?
No, no, they were all from Executive Outcome, almost without exception.
Yeah. And where did Executive Outcomes recruit from mainly? Was it ex-paras and Marines?
No, Executive Outcomes was almost exclusively ex-South African Defence Force, either parachute, parabat, or recce, which is their equivalent of Special Forces. But many of them were from the notorious 3-2 Battalion, because, I mean, 80% of Executive Outcomes were black. And those guys came from 3-2 Battalion, who were basically people who the South Africans recruited in Angola to fight for the South Africans against the MPLA, the then Angolan government. Actually, still the Angolan government, but yeah. It's a complicated and long story. I mean, Angola was the worst, and most intense proxy war of the entire Cold War. And it was real war. I mean, the, you know, heavy artillery, fighters, dogfighting, tanks, etc. And most people actually in the UK are pretty ignorant of the whole thing. They don't even know where Angola is, most people. But it was a major war.
Yes. Well, they saw that. I mean, they had it bad, didn't they? Originally, Portugal didn't want to give its colonies up, so there was a brutal fight there. Then they had all the civil war again. It's just...
Yeah, well, for the poor old Angolans. I mean, actually, this was one of the reasons I was so angry when UNITA went back to war. Mm-hmm. You know, I just thought it was an outrageous thing to do, because, as you say, they'd had this incredibly long war. They'd fought against the Portuguese. There were about three or four different factions who fought against the Portuguese. Portuguese packed it up and ran away in 76 when they had their own coup in Portugal, if you remember. And then the civil war started, which was MPLA backed by Russia and Cuba against UNITA, the guerrillas, backed by the United States and South Africa. And I knew Zavimbi. I mean, I actually spent 4 hours with Zavimbi talking about the whole thing, the whole story. And he promised. I was with Lord Steel, the liberal, the leader of the House in Scotland, David Steel, who's a very good guy. And he and I went and saw Zavimbi. We spent 4 hours with them. I mean, the only reason I saw Zavimbi because I was with Lord Steel. I mean, Zavimbi wouldn't have seen me otherwise. But I was sort of David Steele's bag carrier. But actually, I was a little bit more than that, because we wanted to make sure that if Zavimbi won, the oil company that I was by then working for would be still regarded as friendly.
Yeah,
but, you know, the whole thing there about him, and he looked us in the eye, and I actually don't think UNITA intended to go back to war. I think they were pushed back into it. I don't think it was their decision.
Well, there's massive wealth in that part of the world, isn't it? The massive, massive natural resources and...
Well, I mean, Angola is just the most incredible country. I mean, it's three times the size of France. You've got oil, copper, gold, diamonds, fish in the sea, fantastic farmland. I mean, it's just the most fabulous place.
Yes, and destroyed by years of civil war. I mean, how many landmines must be in the ground there?
They are working their way through it. They're sorting it out slowly but surely.
Simon, I'm conscious of your time here. Can you just give us an idea of what was it like in a foreign prison, and what mindset do you have to adopt?
The mindset thing is pretty important. But, you know, people come to me and they say, oh, well, you know, it doesn't compare with you, but I actually spent 2 weeks in a jail in, you know, wherever, Burkina Faso or something. But of course, that's nothing like what you had to do. I said, no, it's fine. One day is a day too many. you know, your 2 weeks would have been hell. So it's, I understand exactly what you're talking about. And I mean, one of the sort of weird things about it is that it's almost, it's a double punishment, or even a treble punishment in a sense, because, you know, I'm sure UK prisons are not all that pleasant, although some of them look pretty good. But your family can come and visit you. You know, my family couldn't come and visit me. And also, if you make a joke with your fellow prisoners about, you know, what a load of rubbish a certain football team is, they will understand it. If you're in Zimbabwe, they don't. And so you're in a kind of exile. You know, you're in a cultural exile. And I think that makes it much harder. And then, of course, when I got to Equatorial Guinea, because, you know, I did I did 4 years in Chikurubi, in Harare, and then I was kind of kidnapped out of that prison, and I was smuggled to Equatorial Guinea, where they put me in Black Beach there. And in Black Beach, I was in solitary confinement, you know, strict solitary confinement, for 18 months.
God. That's either character building or character breaking, isn't it?
Yeah, probably. But I mean, you've got no choice. So you just got to.
What did they feed you?
In Zim, they just feed you sadza, which is, you know, boiled up mealy meal. Sadza in the evening, and what they call bota, which is the same meal but cooked a different way, for porridge in the morning. And that's it, basically. But luckily, having a super wife and family, I had extra food.
Oh, they could subsidize you, could they?
Yeah, so, you know, that I get some tins of sardines or something like that.
And Simon, if I may say so, you look remarkably healthy for... Are you 70 now? Would that be right?
68.
Yeah. My God, you're out doing, well, a lot of guys in their 50s, I'd say.
Well, I try and run every day. I really try and keep fit.
Yeah. What are your times like? Do you find them slipping as you get older?
Definitely. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
I try and stick to this thing that you should be able to do 10Ks. In the same number of minutes as you are old in years.
Ah, okay.
Now, obviously, if you're 25, that's going to be extremely difficult. But it's quite a good benchmark as you get older.
Yeah. I'm not particularly good at doing maths on the spot, but I'll have to work that out. I'm running 200 miles this month.
Oh, my God. Right. Okay.
Yes. One of these silly things that I do. I've got this project called Running Homeless for Christmas.
Okay.
And I'm just going to hit my running track and just run 200 miles. And if I can do it in 2 days, great. Then I get home for Christmas Eve. If I don't, then I'm out for the long run. I want to just do what I can to highlight the veterans' plight, the amount of our service personnel that suffer with trauma and subsequently housing problems.
Yeah.
But yeah, I hope that day doesn't come when I can't keep pretending I'm 21.
Yeah, no, well, that, it will. I mean, I'm very lucky, but I find now, you know, you get an injury, you pick up a minor injury, like a tweaked knee, you know, which back in the day would have cured quickly. And now it sort of stays with you. You can't run for quite a while. And then that means, you know, when you do start running again, you've got to be very careful. You don't pick up another injury. And, you know, it just, you know, you just got to be quite a lot more careful.
Yes, I bet. Body management.
Yeah. But I think it's also the same, you know, with the whole mental health thing as well, you know. I think the guys, some of the guys have a real problem with asking for help. and sort of, you know, understanding that they can't do what they used to be able to do, you know, because we all, you got your background, my background, we all set such an incredibly high, we set very, very high standards for ourselves, of fitness, of mental toughness and all the rest of it. And I think, you know, that becomes dangerous, actually, as you get older. You don't want help. You don't want to tell anybody you're not feeling well. And that is a real issue, I think.
Yes, very much so. Anyone out there struggling, there's phone numbers at the bottom of my YouTube video that you can reach out and talk to somebody.
Yeah, you've got to do it. You know, I mean, I get asked, you know, well, how is your mental health? You know, 18 months in solitary confinement. I mean, that's meant to sort of send anybody round the twist. I mean, and I say, well, you don't ask me. I might think I'm Napoleon and everything's fine. You know? But I did a talk actually to the SDS Regimental Association just before Christmas actually, and I knew that the association wanted me to talk about the whole business of sort of you know, asking for help. I thought, God, I cannot stand up in front of them and tell them they've got to ask for help. You know, that's not going to work. So I turned it around completely, and I cited two people who I knew were heroes to the audience, you know, all SAS guys. David Sterling, who I really knew quite well, and Peter de la Billiere, who I also really knew quite well and worked for both of them actually on different occasions. And I said, you know, the amazing thing about both those guys is that anybody felt with them that they could go and talk to them. Considering who they were fantastically approachable. So if somebody wanted to ask for help, they would accept that 100% and they would welcome it. And I thought, my idea was that by turning it around, I got the same message across to the guys without sounding patronizing, or, you know.
Yes.
It's true though, because both of those guys are incredibly approachable.
Do you know Damien Lewis?
No, I don't.
Damien writes a lot of SAS type memoirs, not personal memoirs, but about the a regiment.
Okay.
And he came on the podcast the other day. He's a very famous author. And
I've seen his book.
Yeah. He was saying how much like the amount of trauma somebody like Paddy Mayne must have accumulated during their service, with the, you know, the untold acts of warfare that he was involved in, and how back then you just had the drink and you didn't have this thing where you could reach out to people.
I agree with you. And I was actually quite, what was that book called? SES Heroes, the one, it was a big success, two or three years ago. I can't actually remember the name of the title, but it was an official history of the SAS in the war. And I was shocked how much they were drinking at the time. Mm. Never mind afterwards.
Yes.
But Paddy Mayne, in fact, actually at the dinner that I did this talk I just talked about just now, mentioned just now, there was a guy there who had served in two SAS in the war. And he said, well, I was lucky. I didn't have to do selection like you all did. He said, really? You didn't do selection? He said, no, we didn't do selection those days. I just got interviewed by Paddy Mayne. And I said, well, I think actually probably selection would be easier than being interviewed by Paddy Mayne.
Yes. I got a feeling a bottle of whiskey came into that interview. It's a benchmark.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I must admit, I've got just lately, people have asked me about, you know, the lockdown and all this, the whole COVID-19 thing. And so what do you think about it? And what do you think Colonel David would have thought about what's, you know? I said, well, I don't think he would have regarded stay safe as a very good way of saying goodbye to people. Stay safe.
Yes. That's a whole other.
There's nothing safe about him.
No. It's amazing that you know him. I mean, he's obviously legendary, David Stirling.
Totally, absolutely amazing guy. I mean, just incredible guy. I was very, very lucky to get to know him actually quite well.
Yeah. Simon, well,
it wasn't entirely luck actually, because I sort of blagged my way in and, you know, got to know him and started working for him. But I kind of cold called him, which was an interesting moment. But anyway.
Yeah. Sounds like you can get away with that sort of thing in the SAS. I appreciate
that was the thing. He really was very approachable. And the first time I met him, I was absolutely terrified. You know, I knew who he was. I was a very young officer in the Scots Guards and I was very bored. You know, I'd been to Northern Ireland twice and that was a pain in the ass. And I knew he was up to all sorts of interesting things. And I went in and see him in his beautiful office above Goods in South Audley Street, 22 South Audley Street. So it's 22, the address is 22 SAS. And lovely office, went in, and it was evening, with no lights, and this great big desk, beautiful office, and he's sitting there. He said, oh, come in, sit down. Yeah, I'm just about to light a cigar, but it's the last one. But I haven't lit it yet. I tell you what, I'll toss you for it. And it's just a stupid small thing, but he had the gift that he could put someone at ease, you know.
Mm. Yes, a leader of men.
Absolutely amazing guy, yeah.
So thank you ever so much for your time. It's been a fascinating chat. I'm going to put all your links. Your LinkedIn LinkedIn page I can put,
yeah, just LinkedIn, because I don't really do the others.
Yeah,
and you can mention the book if you like. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, long gone. And will you send me the link so I can put them on my LinkedIn as well?
Absolutely, yes, thank you. And let's chat again if that's okay. That'll be my pleasure.
Sure, well, that's fine. No, and I enjoyed it. My pleasure too.
Yes. Take care. Speak soon.
All right, then. Thanks.
Simon.
Cheers, Nat.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Friends, thank you for listening to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast. Please like, subscribe and share. And don't forget to follow me on social media. Username, Chris Thrall. Instagram, Chris.Thrall. Thank you.